In Northern California, a man sacrifices everything he owns to prove his sister's death wasn't an accident. His only support is a sympathetic detective who has come up with an alluring theory. A young woman goes missing, and everyone around her believes she was murdered. Texas investigators have a suspect and a motive, but they have no proof, at least not yet. In Colorado, a sexual predator terrorizes a quiet neighborhood. When he ends his murderous spree, the resourceless authorities have no way of finding him. Anyone can kill and get away with it, at least for a while. But until a murder is solved, the case remains open. Justice never forgets. For this episode, some names have been changed. On February 22, 1985, officers from the Palo Alto Police Department in California were dispatched to the home of James and Abby Nibauer. James Nibauer, 56, said his wife, a well-known local poet, had been accidentally shot. When police entered the home, they found the body of the 47-year-old mother of three lying on the floor. She had been fatally shot in the chest with a shotgun. Police recovered the weapon, a partially dismantled antique, from the floor near the body. On the table next to it were wax, rags, and other cleaning supplies. Crime scene examiners photographed the scene. James Niebuhr, a physical therapist at a local public school, gave his version of events. His wife had gone shopping earlier that afternoon. He had just returned from a ski trip with his youngest son. He was finishing up repairing an old rifle that he planned to give as a gift to one of his children. When Abby returned home a few hours later, he was eager to show her the results of his work. As she admired the craftsmanship of the barrel, the gun went off. James could not explain why the gun was loaded or why it had fired. He had just lost the woman he had married 27 years earlier. During the autopsy, the medical examiner determined that the victim's death had been caused by a bullet to the heart. Death had been instantaneous. The doctor also examined the gunpowder burns on her blouse. Based on their size and location on the sleeves, he concluded that they corroborated James's version of events, namely, that Abby had been leaning over the barrel when the gun went off. As soon as news of her death spread throughout Palo Alto, the victim's friends contacted the police. They were all convinced that Abby's tragic death was not accidental. A close friend told police that James and Abby's relationship had deteriorated in recent years. She believed that Lenny Bauer was only together for the sake of their children. In fact, Abby was even planning to file for divorce as soon as their youngest son left for college in a few months. In the meantime, she had converted the garage of the house into an apartment for herself to reduce any source of tension. James refused to let her leave. He often threw tantrums and accused Abby of seeing other men. She had come to fear for her safety. Despite James Niebuhr's version of events, the victim's friends all believed that Abin would never have approached him while he was holding a gun. Ballistics experts examined the old rifle. Despite a thorough examination of the trigger mechanism, they found no obvious defects and could not explain why the gun had gone off spontaneously. In the absence of evidence, the police had no choice but to conclude that Abby's death was accidental. They turned over his wife's gun and clothes to James Neuer. In Olympia, Washington, more than 600 miles away, Lee Sensen, the victim's brother, was following the investigation. He knew of his sister's stormy relationship with her husband and also refused to believe that her death was accidental.
A friend of my sister sent me a newspaper clipping.
I was very surprised when I read that the police believed the accident theory.
It was the last thing I would have thought.
Brother DB went to the Palo Alto District Attorney's office in the hopes of convincing investigators to take over the case.
He had no physical evidence, but he believed he knew his brother-in-law's motive.
A few weeks before Abby's death, he had settled the estate of their recently deceased parents. Abby was set to inherit $180,000. She had confided in her brother that she was considering depositing the money in an account that James would not have access to. However, if Abby were to die before her divorce was finalized, the money would automatically go to James Niebuhr. This was exactly the scenario that was about to unfold. Unfortunately, Sansom was unable to convince the authorities that his suspicions were correct. He figured that in order to bring justice to his sister, he would have to find physical evidence himself. While he was trying to figure out how to get his brother-in-law charged, he received a letter from the Palo Alto authorities.
I received a letter that basically said that the prosecutor knew what he was doing and that there was no reason to continue the investigation.
Sans was unable to accept this decision. He gave up his job as a programmer analyst to devote all his time and money to bringing justice to his sister.
Financially, I lost all the savings I had set aside for my retirement, as well as my parents' inheritance. There were long periods of time where I could only wait for things to happen. It was really tough.
Eight years went by without any progress. That's when Sansom learned about an association of families of homicide victims. The members of the group agreed to help him get the investigation started. They contacted the Palo Alto Police Department so many times that the authorities finally agreed to re-examine the circumstances surrounding Abby's death. When Detective Michael Yor searched the files, he was surprised because he found...
My first impression was that a homicide had indeed been committed. This was not an accident.
With the help of Lee Sensum, Detective Yor, a firearms expert, found the old rifle and examined it personally. In the end, there were more questions than answers.
It took 15 pounds of pressure to this type of rifle. How could the FU and stock have been unscrewed and removed without realizing that there was a bullet in the rifle and that it was cocked?
This question forced the detectives to reopen the case. They began by questioning Annie Bauer's youngest son, who was living in the house at the time. He stated that he and his father had returned from a ski trip a day early. Upon entering the house, his father had stopped suddenly to check if Abby was with another man. Abby was absent. His father seemed agitated and suggested that he go out and have some fun that evening. The young man found this odd, since he always forbade him to go out, even on weekends. He went out, never to see his mother alive again. Detective Yor believed that James Neuwer had taken his son out because he did not want two witnesses. Until investigators could prove that Ab had been murdered, the official version of her death would remain an accident. Ten years after Abed Niebauer's death,
I know.
Police in Palo Alto, California, reopened the investigation. Her husband, James, had claimed that he had accidentally killed her while cleaning an old rifle. The police now had good reason to believe that she had been murdered, but they lacked evidence to support their presumption. Convinced that they might have missed something, Detective Michael reviewed the coroner's records. The medical examiner had said that the burns from the explosive powder on her blouse indicated that she had been leaning toward the barrel when the gun went off. Examining the photographs, Detective Yor came to a different conclusion. The burn marks were located on the outer part of his forearm, Bakuriwin.
Someone reaching for the rifle would not be able to receive a shock to the heart? This was a question mark. How could this have happened?
To find out, Detective Yor devised his own experiment using the old rifle. Using mannequins kindly provided by a department store and some of his own white shirts, he attempted to recreate the burns on the clothing initially based on his husband's version of events. The scenario did not produce the same type of burn at all. York continued his analysis by changing the position of the mannequin's arms and the shooting distance. After several attempts, he finally obtained the same burn marks as those observed on the clothing. At a distance of 27 centimeters, the detonation gave identical results. The defensive position of the arms indicated that Abin knew perfectly well what fate awaited him.
The scenario had now completely changed. She no longer willingly looked at the gleaming clean gun, the barrel directly over her heart. The barrel was indeed over her heart, but she seemed terrified like the characters in the movies.
A private forensic analysis firm corroborated Detective Yor's findings. Now, the Palo Alto District Attorney also believed that James Niebauer had murdered his wife. James Neuwer, now in his 70s, was arrested at the Tacoma Airport in Seattle as he returned from a trip to Germany. He was being flown to California, where he stood trial for the murder of his wife. Police believe James Neuer knew a divorce was inevitable. The only way he could profit from his wife's newfound inheritance was to kill her as soon as possible. After encouraging his son to leave, he loaded the old gun and waited for his wife to arrive. As soon as she entered the kitchen, he fired at her, killing her instantly. He then faked the scene to make it appear as if he was cleaning his gun. In 1999, James Neuer was convicted of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to 27 years in prison. For the victim's brother, Lee Sensum, it was the end of a long fight for justice, but not the end of the mystery. I still wonder why he killed my sister after being married to her for so long. He didn't do it in a fit of rage. He planned it. I don't know how he got there. Some homicide investigations drag on for years without making any progress. Fortunately, the justice system has a long memory. Forensic science is constantly improving and can easily revive an investigation. Houston, Texas, July 25, 1987. In the afternoon, a crew of road workers was getting ready to end their shift on a rural road. For no reason, a passing motorist started shooting at them. A worker was shot in the leg. One of his colleagues noted the license plate number of the pickup before it disappeared. This information was quickly relayed to the Harris County Sheriff's Office. A few hours later, Detective Marcel Dion discovered that the vehicle came from a car dealership whose owner was Michael Neal. The police went to the scene to question him. A young employee named Tracy Joe Shine said that Michael Neal was not there. When they asked her to tell them where he was, they noticed that she was speaking incoherently. She seemed unable to answer their questions. Tracy Joe appeared to be on drugs. I tried to get her to tell me where Michael Neal was because I was looking for him. The police asked her permission to visit the premises. Near her, a bag containing powder was found. In another room was a clandestine laboratory for amphetamine. A type of stimulant. Although Tracy Joe claimed to have nothing to do with it, she was placed under arrest. Michael's brother and co-owner of the car dealership, Bobby Neal, was also arrested for illegal drug manufacturing. When Tracy Joe learned of the charges against her, she said she was prepared to tell what she knew. She and Michael Neal were in love. He lived together. Although she didn't know where he had gone, she told police that he was the one who had shot the road worker. They had gone for a drive together in his pickup truck. Michael was shooting at random targets. At one point, he had told her it would be fun to shoot the road workers. Tracy Joe didn't know if he really intended to shoot them. She said she would testify against him in court if the police dropped the drug manufacturing charges against her. In the meantime, she refused to sign her statement. She was released on bail.
As she left, she promised me that she would return and help me with this investigation.
More than a month passed without a call from this witness. On September 9, Tracy Joe's mother, Virginia Shine, went to the police station. She had not heard from her daughter in nearly 3 weeks. Tracy Joe Shine, the star witness in an attempted murder trial, was now missing. Police in Harris County, Texas, were narrowing their focus on Michael Neal, the prime suspect in a shooting that left a road worker injured. Tracy Joe Shine, his girlfriend, had agreed to testify against him, but she had since disappeared. This disappearance did not bode well, but perhaps she had left town to avoid testifying against Michael. Detective Marcel Dion then received a crucial call. His interlocutor refused to show up. She claimed to have information about a man who had murdered his girlfriend in his home.
The young woman's body had allegedly been placed in a barrel of muriatic acid after being dismembered. The informant gave me the names of the two people involved, Michael Neal and Tracy Joe Shine.
Joe, the woman on the other end of the line, had heard that after 3 days, Michael Neal had put the remains of the victim's body in a refrigerator that he had left on the dealership's lot. Investigators obtained a warrant authorizing them to search the premises. Harve County Forensics began searching while Michael Neal was away. On the side of the building, they found an old abandoned refrigerator. The door was wide open as if someone had tried to air it out. It appeared to have been recently washed, but forensics quickly realized that it had not been thoroughly cleaned. There was still residue, including a fragment of what appeared to be human flesh. The sample was collected for laboratory analysis. In 1987, DNA analysis was still in its infancy and required a significant amount of genetic material. In this case, in particular, only one thing could be concluded. It was indeed human flesh that came from a woman. All the samples had been used for analysis. No further examination was possible. For investigators, however, this discovery corroborated the informant's statement regarding Tracy Joe's murder. Over the next few months, detectives searched the area in hopes of finding the young woman's body. When the investigation into Tracy Joe Shane's disappearance was not progressing, it was abandoned. 12 years passed. Then, in 1999, Harris County detectives formed a special squad to solve the growing number of unsolved crimes. While reviewing old case files, they stumbled upon Tracy Joe's. Her disappearance deserved some attention. Detective Roger Worth believed he could take advantage of the years that had passed since then.
The number of divorces is increasing, and women are more likely to talk about their ex-husbands than their current ones. They feel less threatened. Sometimes they are also incarcerated. In this sense, time is sometimes our best friend. Time had certainly taken its toll on Bobby Neal, the suspect's brother. He had been incarcerated 12 years earlier for manufacturing amphetamines. His case for parole was due to be reviewed soon. He was ready to eat. Bobby said that at the time of Tracy Joe's disappearance, he had gone to his brother's house. He found Michael in the garage putting a refrigerator in his van. To mask the foul odor that was filling the garage, Michael had set it on fire and helped his brother put the appliances in his vehicle. They then drove to the dealership lot where they unloaded the refrigerator. Barbie said he didn't know what was inside. The little information he had provided forced investigators to re-examine the refrigerator. After dismantling the appliance, the forensics team began searching for clues. They found that many biological samples had escaped the initial examination. Although no control samples from Tracy Joe were available, the clues were sent to Gene Screen, a genetics lab that had opened in the year following the victim's disappearance. The refrigerator had been stored in uncontrolled police storage for 12 years, and forensic scientist William Watson had little hope.
I didn't think it was possible to obtain a DNA profile from the samples, given the conditions in which they had been stored for so long.
In fact, the samples were in too poor a condition to be analyzed in the usual way. However, a new procedure had been developed called mitochondrial DNA sequencing. This technique examines specific DNA sequences in the nucleus of a cell passed down from mother to child. This would allow forensics to determine whether the latest samples collected from the refrigerator were indeed from Virginia Shine's biological child.
This was the ideal type of analysis for this case, because we had exhausted all other possibilities. Not much had been discovered with the samples found in the refrigerator in 1987. All we knew was that they were human tissue. Without mitochondrial DNA sequencing, we would have found nothing else.
The procedure was successful. Forensics then compared the DNA obtained with that of Tracy Joe's mother, Virginia Shine. The results were conclusive. In the meantime, the few samples were enough to represent the victim's body. After 12 years of waiting, scientific advances in forensic science had made it possible to prove that Tracy Joe Shine had been the victim of murder. On January 1, 2000, Michael Neal, who was incarcerated on an unrelated charge, learned that Tracy Joe's body had been definitively found in his refrigerator. To avoid the death penalty, he admitted his crime. He claimed that when he learned that she was cooperating with police in the shooting of the road worker, he flew into a rage and strangled her. 3 days later, he cut up her body and put it in his refrigerator before disposing of it. After pleading guilty, Michael Neal was sentenced to 45 years in prison for first-degree murder.
When investigating a homicide, investigators are usually faced with one of two situations. Either the evidence is missing, or there is no suspect who matches the evidence.
Fort Collins, Colorado, August 29, 1989.
In the afternoon, a real estate agent was showing a home in a nice neighborhood to interested buyers. Upon entering the master bedroom, they made a gruesome discovery. The owner of the property, Sarah Dean, a 39-year-old woman, was lying dead on the floor. After receiving a frantic emergency call, officers from the Fort Collins Police Department rushed to the scene. In an upstairs bedroom, they found the victim with a telephone cord wrapped around her neck. Sarah Dean had been raped and murdered. A glass of water was spilled near her body. Her assailant had probably surprised her. The bathroom next to the bedroom was searched. In the bathtub, officers noticed residue of leaves and dirt. The window was unlocked. It was possible to deduce that the murderer had entered through that. To find further evidence, the experts subjected the room to a laser beam. This light beam reveals proteins present in bodily fluids. Several stains were noted. Samples were collected and carefully preserved. Outside the residence, the police found a handprint on the locked kitchen window. At this time, it was not possible to determine who had left it there and when. There were no other signs of forced entry. During the autopsy, the medical examiner confirmed that Sheridan had been savagely beaten before being raped and strangled. He collected traces of semen and later determined through blood typing that it matched the other samples collected at the crime scene. All came from a single individual. The police then focused on the palm print in the hopes of discovering the identity of the murderer. Although the print was very clear, it was not part of the database. Until investigators could match it to a suspect, Sarah Dean's killer could remain at large. Fort Collins, Colorado, police officers were trying to solve the investigation into Sheridan's brutal rape and murder. They had collected incriminating physical evidence at the crime scene, but they had no suspects. Using photos taken at the scene, they developed a profile of Sarah's killer. To reach the unlocked upstairs bathroom window, he had to climb a fence, grab a gutter, and then leap to the roof. So he was young and agile, probably a teenager. With so much physical evidence, Lieutenant Jim Broderick now had to figure out how to identify a suspect. Throughout the investigation, there was confidence that we were finding clues to the killer, but who he was. Broderick entered Sarah Dean's name into the police database. It had been a recent entry, 10 days before her murder, she had filed a police report. According to the case file, she had called the police after returning home late one evening and discovering that her belongings had been burglarized. Among the stolen items were a tape recorder, a blue and red gym bag, two bottles of wine, and black underwear. Investigators believe that the two crimes were clearly connected. The fetishistic aspect of the theft fit perfectly with the sexual nature of the murder. Lieutenant Broderick deduced that the burglary had served as a kind of rehearsal for the young killer. He was familiar with the layout of the premises. Perhaps he even knew, based on the time he had spent in the house during the theft 10 days earlier, that some of the windows were unlocked. Although the evidence suggested that the killer was a stranger, the possibility that he was one of the victim's acquaintances should not be dismissed too quickly. The police questioned Sarah Dean's colleagues and friends, starting with her fiancé. He and Sarah had recently become engaged and were planning to marry in a few months. They were both looking forward to the life ahead of them. He had no idea who might have killed Sarah. Before they let him go, the police took a sample of his blood. Serological tests showed that he was not involved in the murder. Over the next few months, hundreds of local residents, including convicted sex offenders, were interviewed. All were asked to provide blood samples. I think we collected blood from 300 or 400 people to compare with evidence from the crime scene. But we didn't find a suspect. The search for Sarah's killer was fruitless. Then, in September 1989, a month after the murder, the Fort Carlins police found a new clue. They had discovered an abandoned car on the side of a road that had been reported stolen a few days earlier. Inside, police found a baseball cap with the name D.T. Jr. written on it. Since detectives believed the car had been stolen by teenagers, they called local high schools to find a teenager with the same initials. They found one. Douglas Vess Jr., 16, was called in for questioning. When shown the cap, he stated that he had lent it to friends a few weeks earlier, and that they had never returned it to him. In the presence of his mother, Thez had stolen the car. He seemed willing to cooperate and gave investigators the names of two of his friends. Within hours, police located the two young men. Not only did they admit to stealing the car, but they also admitted to being part of a burglary ring involved in the theft of several residences in the area. They showed police where he hid the stolen property. Among the electronics and other items, police found a blue and red gym bag like the one Sarah Dean had said had been stolen 10 days before his murder. When police told the teens that the item linked them to a homicide, they said they know nothing about this case. They refused to release the names of the other teens involved in the burglaries. Police collected blood samples and fingerprints from both young men, but there was no way to connect them to the crime scene evidence. For more than 6 years, the investigation stalled. In July 1995, things finally changed. A furnace repairman working in a rented house made a strange discovery. While trying to unclog an air duct, he discovered women's underwear stuffed into the duct. Remembering the details of the Saradin case, he called the police. Lieutenant Broderick answered the call. He hoped this would finally be the lead they had been missing for so long. The underwear matched the description of the underwear stolen from Saradin's home 10 days before his murder. The lieutenant sent them to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. Forensic lab examiner Ted Davis collected the biological evidence. Even though the samples had been sitting in an air duct for 6 years, DeVallis was able to obtain the suspect's DNA profile from the evidence on the underwear. He then compared it to the DNA profile obtained from Saradin's crime scene. DeVallis was able to conclude that all the samples came from a single person. After linking the crime scene to the rented house, investigators looked into who had been living there at the time of the murder. Luckily, the manager had kept his information. In August 1989, the house had been rented by a family with teenage children. Among them was Douglas Thezas Jr., the young man who had provided information to investigators 6 years earlier. Using the Colorado State Database, it was learned that the now 22-year-old lived in Grand Junction, a city several hundred miles away. Detective Rodrigue traveled to the city with a court warrant forcing Douglas Thees to provide a blood sample and fingerprints. He found the suspect hard at work repairing the roof of a house. He was taken to the station for questioning. After a few hours, Viz still refused to cooperate. Convinced that he was hiding something, the detectives took his fingerprints and a blood sample before releasing him. After obtaining Douglas Thess Jr.'s DNA, DeVallis compared it to the samples from the crime scene and underwear found in the air duct. All the samples were exactly the same. Fort Collins police had just caught the colleague of Saradin's killer. They headed back to Grand Junction, this time armed with an arrest warrant. Douglas Thess Jr. was taken into custody and charged with Saradin's murder in 1989. Police believe that 10 days after breaking into Saradin's home, the 16-year-old sexual predator entered her home again by entering through the bathroom window. He surprised Saradin. She probably never had time to process what was happening to her. Douglas Dios was sentenced to life in prison for this first-degree murder. When a homicide investigation is not solved quickly, some murderers feel safe. But
but investigators are patient. They know that one day forensics will help them solve these cases. Justice never forgets.